absolutely right. There is the contract, and there's the related SLEs, SLAs, which are really part of the contract, but also part of a separate discussion being led by Paul Kane primarily. And both of those need to be implemented. And I agree that the easiest, most straightforward way is just to leave the CWG in existence. The other possibility is to put in place an implementation review team, which would probably vastly resemble the CWG. So at that point, it's just semantics. Tony?
Yeah, I just wanted to make the point on that. And as Malcolm said, this is something that's being discussed and is going to be discussed later today in the ISP group. If we are going to support that, I would urge that the constituencies also put in some comments strongly supporting that move as well. It may not be enough that that group itself just says, we think we need to stay as a group for the next phase. It needs to get some community backing for that. So I would urge, if you do think that's a good way to go, that maybe from the constituencies you could reflect that in a message back as well. Steve.
Thanks, Tony. Steve Del Bianco. During this phase of the discussion on the CWG stewardship transition, the observations and comments that are being made, Ann, Malcolm, and Steve made a couple yesterday in the afternoon, I'd like to understand the degree to which your concerns should be reflected anywhere in the council motion that will be voted on tomorrow. As all of you know, there's a motion to simply have council approve the CWG final proposal and send it on into the ICG. It's not a very long motion. I put a link to it in the chat if anybody wants to bring it up, but it endorses the proposal and makes a point about implementation and timing. But are we comfortable that the concerns that have been raised so far by the three of you can be worked out during the next public comment, which will occur in late August and September? Or are they things that need to be reflected in council's motion someplace? Thank you.
Steve?
Well, this is Steve Metalitz. As to the issue that I raised, which is the lack of any review process for a CCTLD delegation and redelegation actions, I got the answer pretty clearly yesterday afternoon that that will not be fixed. So I guess the short answer is no, it can't be reflected in the motion because it's not going to be fixed. I know there's been an enormous amount of effort put into this to try to substitute for the NTIA role in overseeing the IANA functions. But my hope has always been that this could also be an opportunity to improve that through greater transparency. And, this is an opportunity that will be missed here because it's simply been turned back over to the CCs to come up with a review process when and if they feel like doing so, apparently. So I think it's a flaw, and I don't know how serious a flaw it is in the overall picture, but it's clearly not going to be fixed.
Steve Del Bianco.
I'd like to follow up on that. Steve Del Bianco, I was the author of the stress test, and the infamous stress test number 21 is exactly what Steve Metalitz just described. It asked the question, what would happen if a CCTLD manager were revoked without the actual support of the registrants and users in a given country, or if it was reassigned without the support of users and registrants in the country, and what would be the appeals mechanism? We went through this extensively and tried to design in the stress test a way to use the independent review panels and mechanisms that we had. We needed a standard of review and standing. And this came to a head in the Istanbul face-to-face meeting where the government representatives in the GAC as well as CCNSO took it away. It wasn't as if, Steve, that the CWG or the CCWG dumped it to the GNSO. Let me be clear. They snatched it away. They did not want this transition group trying in any way to interfere with a process they felt they were along in the process of. For instance, the framework of interpretations was presumably the way they were going to work out the degree of consensus that was required to make this reassignment. And they did not want us to interfere in that. The GAC was a little bit confused, saying that they generally were okay with the framework of interpretation, and they didn't know to what extent the GAC would participate in the CCNSO's process of coming up with the implementation of those rules. So this wasn't an abrogation of responsibility. We wanted to tackle this, and we're told hands off.
Ben.
Yes, thank you. I don't know much about the comment on this particular issue, but with respect to Steve's question as to whether the motion needs to be amended, I think, yes, it should be, and not in an obstructionist way, not to stop it, but just a friendly amendment that, you know, community recognizes there are, as Greg said, implementation issues that should be accomplished prior to presenting proposal to NTIA, and that the CWG should continue and should continue to work on those issues, including the contract. Now, the most efficient way to state that would probably be a very short amendment to the section that now talks about, I think, and when the GNSO reviews accountability, it'll let everybody know what it thinks about it. But there's some kind of a conditional section in there where I think the motion should be amended. I'd be happy to help work on it if there's agreement to amend it.
Thank you for that, Alfred. I think it would be very helpful for certainly councillors and yourself too, and probably a few others, Malcolm, Greg, Steve, to actually put some effort into doing that, and we'll try and circulate something to council ahead of the council meeting. Okay. Steve, did you want to pick up on the accountability issues from here? Thanks.
Before you do that, on that last point, if this is going to be GNSO Council, so other parts of the council should have advanced sight of any proposed amendments we're going to put.
That was my point, that we do something and get it to them in advance. Yes, we need to give a friendly amendment in advance and give them some time to consider that. That's for sure. Thanks. Steve.
Thank you, Tony. As your representative on the CCWG for accountability, I've had plenty of help. I mean, you can't imagine how helpful it has been to have Malcolm and Greg and Jonathan Zook weighing in time and time again to try to keep this ship on course. And by being on course, I'm simply saying that we talked a year ago in this community about what we thought needed to be there to replace the NTIA stewardship role, and that was to empower the community. And if you recall, this group, we put comments in a year ago about the kind of powers that were necessary, the powers to block a bylaw, block a budget, block a strat plan, spill one or all of the board members, and dramatically improve the independent review and redress procedures so that anyone would have standing. They wouldn't look just at whether the process was followed, but look at the substance. And we wanted to find ways to limit the scope of what ICANN can do and bury that in the bylaws in a way that it couldn't be violated in a trivial manner. So all of this a year later has come to pass, where we have fleshed out the details behind that plan, found out from the lawyers supporting the CCWG after $1,500,000 in fees, find out that yes, all of that's possible under ICANN's incorporation as a public benefit company in the state of California, and that in fact the powers that we talked about just now are all going to be enforceable if the need should arise to be enforceable. And there was quite significant consensus around that and support in the public comments, except when it comes to enforceability. That led the CCWG along the way to think that the enforceable part was available to us if we simply converted ICANN to an organization that had members in the California Public Benefit Corporation law sort of way. And we didn't see that as a significant step, but many people did. And I think it was our mistake not to really imagine how that could be perceived and misperceived by folks around the world who are not lawyers, and many on the group who don't use English as their first language. The presumably trivial step of looking at each of the ACs and SOs in the ICANN structure, think of it, an AC, the C is for committee, in an SO, the O stands for organization. So committees and organizations aren't really legal entities. They're groups that the bylaws created. Understand? They weren't groups that were pre-existing and pulled into the vortex of ICANN. ICANN created us and gave us different kind of names. So that's really not sufficient standing to say, under California law, I'm enough of a member, even if I'm identified in the bylaws, I need to be enough of a person that I could exert my legal right to force the company to follow its own bylaws. So we thought this was a relatively trivial step, and I think we drank our own Kool-Aid too much, because it looked to the rest of the world like the need to register as an unincorporated association under California, which is a $25 fee. I think Malcolm offered to pay it for everyone, so the money wouldn't be a problem. To register, it's a one-page form. It just completely set the alarms off around the world with members of different governments, folks in the ALAC. It contributed to the perception that somehow we had created something that was inordinately complex, legalistic, would involve courts all the time. And fortunately, within a few weeks of our first draft going out, we got the message loud and clear. And last Friday, really at the leadership of Becky Burr, who was there at the creation of ICANN with Marilyn, Becky said, you know what, we don't really have to require anybody to register anything. In fact, nobody has to acquire this status of legal personhood unless and until the dark day comes that we have to ask a court to enforce one of our community powers. And for that, I would ask Ozan, if you would put up slide 18. These are the community powers that we're speaking of, the ability to spill the board and so on. And then go to slide 19. In slide 19, we talk about how these powers are exercised. The powers are exercised by, well, empowering the existing ACs and SOs. You see them in the circle in the lower left-hand corner. This wasn't difficult for the CCWG. We looked at the existing bylaws and structure of ICANN and said, don't change anything. Let each of the ACs and SOs simply acquire powers to vote to block a budget, to block a bylaws change, have the fundamental bylaws be subject to approval, etc. And we defined supermajority thresholds, largely in the area of 75%, and most of the public comments supported that. And the notion here, if I were to go through an example, is that if we were to have a board that wanted to change a bylaw we think is vital, and the board wanted to change it in a way that the community, 75% of the votes in the lower left-hand circle, said, we don't believe this is a bylaws change that should go through. And we simply hit the send button on our email, and the GNSO sent in our five votes, and ALAC sent in their five votes. No structure here, just simply voting. And the board said, well, you know, you're at 80%, and I know the bylaws say that you can block this bylaw, but we feel it's in our fiduciary duty to do it, so we're going to do it anyway. If that happened, and only if that happened, any one of those organizations around the circle can pass a one-paragraph resolution saying, we intend to come together for the purpose of exercising our rights and powers as a member of a California corporation, public benefit corporation, as explained in the bylaws. And passing that resolution is sufficient evidence that that entity, GNSO in my example, has the legal personhood necessary to go to court and force the board to follow what the bylaws say they're supposed to do. So I'm not a lawyer, so that explanation is probably inaccurate in ways that Greg is just itching to correct for me. But Greg, if it's close enough for comprehensibility, I'm going to appeal to you not to try to correct it all. Add to it, please, but let's not try to correct it all, because I'm really just trying to make the point that we are not turning to courts. Courts are not involved in any of the processes you see on this slide. This slide is about the community a few times a year having the ability to question and challenge the board on a decision they've made. Another example would be singular and plural. If you recall the dilemma we had on singulars and plurals, where the inexplicable expert panels on string similarity made decisions that way that were inconsistent, even within the same string. We didn't have standing as the registrants and users in the community to challenge that decision. And if we had, they would have only looked at whether the process was followed. And if it was, the reconsideration in IRP would have gone nowhere. So we, in this proposal, have made significant improvements and enhancements to the independent review process. And the independent review process would have allowed us, the way we've redesigned it, would have allowed us to challenge a decision like the singular and plural panel. But the standard of review would have been, well, take a good hard look at the bylaws and the substance of the decision with regard to the bylaws. Who can say whether we'd have been able to overturn the ridiculous string similarity panels? That would be up to the arbitrators to do that. But we are suggesting that the arbitrators themselves would be a permanent panel of seven that are paid by ICANN. They're a standing panel from which one to three would be selected to hear cases. So they would be far more schooled in the arcana of ICANN. There would be the ability to rely upon precedent from previous decisions, and most importantly, their decision, if they overturn, is a binding decision. And that might be an area where you go to a court to enforce a binding decision, but it doesn't require anybody to become a member status. So I'll conclude just by saying that we think we made a breakthrough on Friday at the face-to-face meeting when we realized we don't have to activate the membership gene in the new ICANN organism. It just has to be there, latent, in the bylaws, so that if any of the ACs and SOs decide to activate membership, there's the ability to hold ICANN to the powers that the bylaws will reflect. That means there's really no change at all from an empowered SOAC model unless and until the date ICANN doesn't honor the will of the community. Thank you, Tony.
Okay, thanks. Ellen.
Ellen Shankman. I'm deeply impressed by all the work that you've done and the breakthroughs that you've made. And so my question is coming from a place of complete ignorance. And if it's totally off the wall, just ignore it. But when I hear this as somebody who doesn't live in the United States, the minute I hear that something is giving teeth to give somebody standing in court, I understand the reason we want to do it, but I'm a little bit concerned about, are there any unintended ramifications? Are you suddenly saying that, well, the good news is we'll have this standing so we can go in when we want to have the power to do something against ICANN or challenge some decision, but are you suddenly giving some kind of legal standing to all these people who, by the same token, now can be hauled into court into the U.S. from abroad for just anything and kind of saying, oh, you're actually this kind of member, you become process of service or something like that?
Thanks for that question. And Greg will answer the part of it about standing. But let me suggest to you that the IRP has nothing to do with legal personhood. The IRPs are going to be written in the bylaws that they can be exercised by any aggrieved party or the ACs and SOs, whether they're persons or not. So the only question would be that if someday the board ignored what the bylaws say the powers are, and only then is this issue of asking a court to enforce it. So your question was, does that personhood suddenly create a potential for standing or being sued? And I'll turn to Greg for that.
Okay, before we go down there, Mike, did you want to add something to
that? Yeah, thanks. I have a question. Since I've got quite a bit of experience dealing with ICANN and IRPs right now, and I'm aware that the last IRP that went through, there was about $150,000 in attorney's fees that were allocated and costs. How is the SOs and ACs supposed to enforce these rights against ICANN? Who's paying for that? Where does the budget come from?
Mike, if a supermajority of the community agreed we were going to pursue an IRP, ICANN would pay all the fees. Otherwise,
the arbitration fees. But what about the lawyer? Who's going to represent us? Who pays for that?
All right, we only have our first draft out, and it would have been helpful to have comments in the public comment period. But it would be great for you to share that this week. A number of us believe ICANN should pay the legal fees if the community had a supermajority of those 29 votes bringing an IRP challenge. We think that this has been discussed, but it wasn't fleshed out in our first draft. Our second draft should try to address that. And I personally agree with you.
Mark. Yeah, he's going to come in. But Mark, go ahead.
Mark Trachtenberg for the record. And further to Mike's comments, I'm just really struggling to understand how a stakeholder group could sue in court. Who would represent it? Who would be the client? Who would make the decisions for the stakeholder group? Also, who would pay for it? You're suggesting ICANN's going to pay to sue itself and somehow be the client that is being represented against itself? I mean, I'm just really struggling. And, you know, I don't have the background of being involved in all the meetings, but it just seems to me, from a practical perspective, I just don't understand how it could possibly work.
Yeah, that's the danger of having too many lawyers in the room, because you went straight to the very end result that may never happen, which is to get enforcement of a community power in the event that the board said no. That enforcement action is the only time courts are involved. Are we clear on that, right? So we might exercise these community powers for 15 years before any board stands up and say, you know what, we're not going to listen to the community. And then and only then is it necessary to ask a court to force a company to do what the bylaws say the company had to do. And I have no idea what those legal fees would be, but I don't want to be surprised at how much it can cost. But just so we're clear, when Greg answers your question about that, it probably isn't never going to happen that we need to go to court. And if we did, we'd only have to do it once, because then it would become clear that the community can enforce the bylaws in court. And I don't understand why the board would continue to defy us on another topic that comes down the road later on.
I'm not questioning the rest of the proposal, but if the proposal is founded upon these teeth of this enforceability at the end, then that kind of puts into question other parts of the proposal if the whole thing is based on this power and ability to enforce when that power ability to enforce is not actually there. And I know that you say, well, it probably would never be needed, but again, it seems to me that the entire model is based on having the ability to do this, which I don't think that you could.
Greg.
Sure. I can't say that I have necessarily all the answers, but I think, first off, the way this is contemplated is that if and only if we needed to have a legal person formed to essentially represent or act as a wrapper around the SOAC, then that would happen at that time. For example, and I'll use some words in this room which give other people itchy fits, but it's the easiest way to express them among people who can rationally listen to legal terms without breaking out in hives. For instance, if the GNSO wanted to take this step, they would enter into this resolution, which is sufficient to form what would be called, if it were to make a profit, a general partnership, or if it were a nonprofit, an unincorporated association, which is kind of the most minimal element of legal personality that one can wrap around. So there would be this little unincorporated association, this little legal entity that would be formed, and that would be exist solely to take direction from the SOAC, and that entity would be the member of ICANN that would take the actions. If we were to use a California unincorporated association to do this, that is recognized under California law as a legal entity with limited liability protection for its members. So, you know, that's one of the advantages of that particular form. Other groups might choose other forms. It's really up to each of them to decide whether they might be a Swiss Verein or a Japanese whatever it might be. But as long as it's something that can attain legal personhood without a lot of structure, that would be the intent. And similarly, it's onto the next question, I believe, in terms of who pays. It's not at all uncommon in contracts, in indemnification provisions, to say that among the things that are being indemnified are challenges by one party to the other party. So the idea that ICANN would pay to have you sue it is not far-fetched in terms of precedent. It's far-fetched maybe in terms of ICANN being happy about it, but their alternatives are limited. Because ICANN is in California, the easiest place to sue it is in California, and frankly, it wouldn't necessarily need to be a California unincorporated association that was formed. Indeed, one might argue that depending upon what the cause of action is and other factors, you might want to create diversity by having the legal entity come from a state other than California. But that's the kind of very low-level detail compared to what we're talking about here. In terms of who might be amenable to getting sued at that point, once you've formed that entity, it is true that that entity could be sued. But the individual members of the SOAC or even the SOA itself should not be open to suit under that kind of model. I'm no, I don't litigate much anymore, if ever, and so I'm not going to hold myself out as a world foremost authority on that. But the general understanding is that if you form an organization with limited liability, that that's what would be sued. And then we also have to consider, you know, what are the causes of action here? And secondly, I know there's something that none of us actually wants to think about, which is, are we all amenable to being sued for the decisions and actions that we take in our groups, which are not limited liability organizations? Although we are all under the big umbrella of ICANN, that may be what protects us, and there are certain volunteer statutes that also protect people who volunteer. But the fact that we don't form an unincorporated association doesn't somehow mean that we're immune from suit. You know, one of the great things about the U.S. and terrible things about the U.S. system is anybody who wants to sue anybody or anything else can at least give it a try.
Before I turn to you, Alan, Malcolm.
Thank you. Can I try to give my own answer to? Maybe if I speak more closely to it. Can I try and give my own answer to the questioner about how we would actually go about exercising these powers? How would the GNSO, if the GNSO were the SO that were choosing to sue ICANN to enforce these powers, how would it actually go about hiring lawyers, appointing lawyers, briefing those lawyers, paying for those lawyers? Those are the questions, I think, that we just had. Quite frankly, we don't have the answers to that yet. What you've heard from my colleagues here, I would characterize as speculative approaches to how we might decide this in the future. We don't know the answers to those questions. But what I'd suggest is we don't actually need the answers to those questions at this stage. What we are discussing at the moment is whether it should be possible for the GNSO to, or another SO, to engage in such a suit, whether it should have the right to do so, so that it could then, if it chose to do so at a later stage, decide for itself how to organize itself so as to go about that. We might end up just passing the hat round. We might end up asking ICANN to put in place in advance a fund to support such activities. We may end up within the council creating a structure for the purpose of ensuring that a legal committee, or something. All sorts of things could be done. We don't know this yet. It's not part of the current proposal, at least as it is developed. What must happen, though, what can't be delayed, is the decision as to whether or not an SOAC should have the right to bring such a suit, however it was so organized later. That decision must be taken at this stage. And that is really the key decision that the CCWG is grappling with at the moment, between those of us on the side of enforceability who are saying yes, and we can make this lightweight, and we can make this so that it is as non-disruptive to the current structure as possible, versus those that say we can do without enforceability, that's not a problem.
Ellen.
Thank you. I think you've touched exactly on what I'm trying to get at with my question, because, and as people have heard me say probably way too many and only less than tapestry, which is, what are the whats that we're trying to achieve, and then how are the hows that you can get there? And every how, by definition, has its pluses and minuses. So I'm trying to understand what here are the what questions and what are the how questions. So I see on the table a what question fundamentally being, we want to make the board listen to us when they don't listen to us. That's the situation we got. And whether it's super majorities and playing with the numbers or what to do. But the scenario that Steve did, and excuse my language, is what do we do when the board says fuck you and goes ahead anyway? Okay, so then there are two questions. You either come up with an ICANN-style model that says we're going to do everything but litigation and contracts and go down that route, the same way that the internet has worked until now without litigation and contracts. Maybe, and we've also said putting governments isn't a good idea. I think we have to ask ourselves fundamentally, are putting contracts and litigation into that model the right way to go? And my question about, well, is it going to drag somebody else in, goes to the question of, well, if you do that, remember what's good for the goose is good for the gander. It may give you the teeth to do what you want to do, but it may have unintended consequences about our own liability if we introduce that idea into a model that hasn't been based on that. Once you decide that fundamental question on, yes, we want to go down the contract slash enforceability slash route, whether you actually choose to exercise it or not then becomes a strategic question. But it, if you go that, it has to work, because you can't say, well, I want to put it in there, but I hope I never have to use it. The how then becomes, you know, questions on who's going to pay for it, when do you decide to exercise it. But those, as far as I'm concerned, are hows. And as I said, every how has its pluses and minuses. And at that point, you might decide, well, the how will be that I'll hire this law firm, or I won't hire this law firm, or we'll pay for it this way, or we won't. But I think that the idea of saying that because we can't get there now with voting or numbers or what else, that we want to introduce contracts and litigation into this ICANN internet model as our concept of accountability, as opposed to other oversights or other organizations or other people who have super veto powers over a board that's not listening to us, I think is a very fundamental question that needs to be faced on, do we want this animal in here?
Thanks. The lady on the right, sorry, I can't remember your name, and then Mark and Jonathan.
Aparna Sridhar from Google in the business constituency. I understand there's concern about these enforceability issues, but I think it's important to look at this in the broader picture, right? So let's say, for example, that we are very unhappy with a decision, we try to enforce in court, we have an arbitration successful in favor of the community, we try to enforce in court, litigation takes a in my experience in civil litigation, it takes a long time. Probably in that circumstance, even if litigation is an option, a lot faster to just try to recall the board members we don't like. I think in general, the powers that we're going to have within the community are going to be more nimble. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have litigation as a last resort, but it's important not to lose the forest for the trees.
I won't make my entire point again, but again, the more I hear about how this is going to work, the more questions it raises, and I just can't see any practical way that it would work. I mean, even who's going to be deciding what counsel to select to form the entity itself? I mean, there's just so many questions, and from a practical perspective, it just seems very difficult to implement. And so if the goal is to have some sort of actual enforceability in a worst-case scenario, I think then we should create a situation where it might actually be implementable. And in this situation, it seems to me so theoretical and so complicated that so as not to be effective. And I would only suggest that a simpler model that doesn't involve forming an entity in litigation in court be considered instead of something that is immensely theoretical and probably not implementable on a practical level.
I just respond to that. Okay. I guess you know, we've talked quite a lot about this, and I've been, you know, internally one of the skeptics beating up on the point. And I do actually think it is implementable, especially if you're looking at an unincorporated association really needs nothing more than a one-page resolution. The idea would be that all of the governance would take place within the SOAC, not that you'd have to create this whole second robust membership organization. That's really what we got away from. And I agree with what, if you think about creating a complex organization as a second kind of alter ego, then you have a lot of issues. The idea is to use the member as basically just a point of delivery for the decisions that are made in the SOAC. So the answer is, the decisions would be made the way the GNSO makes decisions. Now that, you know, we can talk about whether the GNSO Council is a great process for managing a litigation. That has its own level of discussion, but I think that's a next level type of issue.
I mean, Jonathan. So every time the lawyer has a question, they're going to go through the process of the SO voting on it? I mean, I mean, think about what you're saying.
Well, let me tell you the way we've handled dealing with the lawyers in both the CWG and the CCWG, which is that we formed small legal sub-teams that dealt with the lawyers, and with the basically combination of the legal sub-team and the co-chairs dealt with the lawyers on significant issues, and the active and engaged members were involved, but we basically agreed that there would be a legal sub-team, just as you might with any organization. You delegate to a subgroup, which is itself accountable to the rest of the group through that group's mechanisms for accountability. So then you can say, well, how accountable is the GNSO Council, either to each other or the rest of us? Again, that's another question. But I think the point is whether it is feasible in the eyes of the board for us to take this hammer out if we need it. This is the hammer of Thor. I don't read a lot of Thor, but I don't think he takes the hammer out unless he needs to. And I think the idea is hopefully we never need to. And I agree with Aparna that we have a number of escalations that are also, in a sense, last resort escalations before this last resort. But the belief is that if we can't ever use the powers, have actual powers to enforce, regardless of the disagreement that the board may have, that without enforcement, there really is no accountability. So counting on the board to trust, to abide by our decisions is actually exactly what we're hoping for. We hope that this never happens. We hope that they never call on us to create such an entity. But I think it's eminently doable when we get there. And whether it ever happens, I don't know.
Jonathan.
Yeah, I know several hours ago I had thought of something to say. I'm trying to come back to it. But I was recently in a trademark dispute over an organization with one of the founders of the organization. And rather than negotiate, she hired a lawyer. And so we had to hire a lawyer. And by the time we were done, we came to a resolution that neither one of us was happy with, and we had spent more money than it would have taken to make her happy in the first place. So my view of lawyers and legal proceedings is quite Shakespearean in many instances. And so if there was some other alternative of enforceability that didn't involve going to court, no one would be happier to hear about it. So what I would like to do is challenge the lawyers in the room to suggest an alternative for enforceability that doesn't involve going to court, because that would make the entire international community thrilled. That being said, we didn't think of one. Our lawyers didn't think of one. We did somehow manage to figure out how to acquire legal counsel for the CCWG. We did find out how to interact with them. We may have spent more money than we would have liked, but the people that are involved in the community have money. There might be the potential to get it from ICANN, but I think that we need fundamentally to build enforceability into this. So if you're making the argument, let's find some other mechanism for enforceability, I'm all for it, because that would eliminate most of what we're fighting about with the rest of the community. But I haven't seen it. And I'm personally not willing to accept a solution that doesn't involve enforceability at some fundamental level, because otherwise I feel like this is a waste of our time. So yeah, the ability, the standing, as a last resort, to go to court and figure it out when that happens, because we're a bunch of smart people, I think has got to be an essential part of this, unless there's really a viable alternative. I just haven't seen it. We need the leverage in order to have the powers that we're listing to work.
Yeah, my name is Jameson Olufuye, BC. I think there has to be some measure of enforcement as a last resort. Basically, we'll have felt that within the community and based on the bylaw, it will have been so possible that once the community have a decision, firm decision, then it should be binding. but there has to be some form of enforcement. Now, the introduction of the issue of court it might not give a lot of confidence to people from my side of the world when it comes to resolving a very sensitive issue pertaining to the global internet. Because in my part of the world, they usually discourage you to go to court because a court case could take about 7 to 15 years. And I think there should be some time bound concerning what we want to resolve. And also, there's a concern that would that be a special court? Usually you have tribunal, maybe within 3 months it does its job. So unless there is some form of a safeguard like that to say, okay, there has to be a special court that will take this within this time period and to resolve it, the matter, then there might be a loss of confidence in the part of court from the point of view of maybe developing nation observers.
Okay, thanks. So we're going to have to wrap this pretty quickly because we have a presentation on human rights. But Phil and then Steve, I saw, wanted to reply. If we can make it very succinct, that would be helpful. Okay.
Yeah, Phil Corwin, business constituency. Seems to me this court option is a bit like having a nuclear weapon. I mean, you want it for the deterrent effect, but you never want to use it because it might result in mutually assured destruction. When you think about the divisiveness and the protracted nature of litigation, it could tear the organization apart if it's actually exercised. I had one question. Does California law permit, and was it considered as an interim step before litigation, mandatory binding arbitration, which sometimes is less, much faster certainly than litigation?
I think the mandatory the IRP that we're putting in place would be turned into a form of binding arbitration, recognizable as binding arbitration under California law, which includes the ability to enforce it under California law. So,
okay. Steve, to wrap up, and then I'm sure there's going to be a lot of discussion in our constituency meetings around this.
That's great. And the co-chairs are visiting with the BC and the IPC today. And since you've seen the presentation, parts of it here today, and you saw many of you saw it yesterday in the town hall, I would encourage you to have interactions with the co-chairs in the nature of what this discussion is. But I would ask you to keep in mind that the breakthrough that I was describing earlier is that to empower the SOs and ACs we already have means to change the bylaws and give us certain delineated powers that the entire CWG for IANA transition is counting on. The slide I put up in front of you is the linkage or dependencies between the two. These six elements on the slide are part of the CWG proposal, the final proposal that we're all about to vote in council to approve tomorrow. They are counting on us putting these enforceable powers someplace in the mix. And that's a dependency that we are determined to honor and meet. So far, the proposal we have will do that. But if there isn't any enforceability, I don't know whether they would go back and rethink whether they truly have the kind of separability that they wanted for IANA or they have the kind of powers that they need. So enforceability, dirty word, hard to get your arms around. If it's a requirement, there has to be a mechanism to trigger that. The breakthrough we had is that as long as the board listens to the powers of the community, there is no need to consider how to enforce. And all we need to do is to put a latent, passive capability to turn that on. The trick is, as Jonathan Zook explained, if we wait until we need it, you won't be able to get that power to enforce. The only leverage point we have is the IANA transition. And we want to bury in the bylaws the simple explanation that ICANN is a membership corporation, just like my trade association, like many associations are, and that as such, those members have the power to enforce the bylaws. It's as simple as that. And if we bury that in the bylaws now, I hope we never have to use it. But when and if we did, it would be simply to enforce the powers of the community. I wanted to close, Tony, by suggesting that we had another surprise on Friday, which was that the ICANN legal team, through the board, submitted a list of 156 questions to us. I described this in emails that I sent to each of you on Sunday, and many of them were very gotcha-type questions. Have you considered the effect on the ombudsman? You know, have you considered and who would pay for
overwhelmingly? Have you considered whether this will overwhelm the ombudsman? So we have the image of an ombudsman dissolving in a puddle of tears.
Yes, and there were a lot of gotcha questions. And have you considered the effect on insurability? And have you considered whether these changes would endanger ICANN's status as a nonprofit corporation? Well, some of these questions I'll just want to answer, well, no, but I'll bet you have. And we want ICANN to explain what concerns they have and not just give us gotcha questions. And we're going through that conversation. I'm happy to report that on Sunday afternoon when the CWG and CCWG met with the ICANN board, they kind of walked that back a little bit and suggested that the questions were meant to be helpful and that they didn't have any expectation that we'd answer them all in great detail. So I'd like to take them at their word on that, and we'll move ahead on that 156 questions in the week ahead. So, Tony, that's about it for now, but we're here all week and answer questions. Thank you.
Okay, and thanks once again to you two guys in particular for doing the heavy lifting on this. Niles, if I could ask to come to the front. So we're going to turn over now to the subject of human rights. We're pretty tight on time because we do have to finish in time to get to our session with the board. So we'll have this presentation and then go through GNSO reform and finally the update on digital services. Over to you when you're ready. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tony. Would be 5 to 10 minutes okay, or too long?
That would be wonderful. Thank you.
Excellent. I created a... first, thank you all very, very much for allowing the cross-community party, working party on ICANN's corporate social responsibility to respect human rights to present its work here to you. And in the spirit of it being a cross-community effort, I really hope we can work together on this issue. I had prepared a presentation, but I see there's no projector on right here. In the meantime, I'll go ahead and perhaps it could be distributed via mailing list because of time. The cross-community working party on ICANN's corporate and social responsibility to respect human rights built on a discussion that has been in the ICANN community for a while but was then converged in the ICANN 50 meeting in London by the report by Thomas Schneider and Monica Zalnierucci, which was facilitated by the Council of Europe. Then at the ICANN 51 session in LA, there was a session on ICANN's corporate responsibility to respect human rights. And that led at ICANN 52 in Singapore for the cross-community working party to be established, just as the GAC working group on human rights and international law. And then there was also the first report, the report on this published by Article 19. And here we are at ICANN 53 in Buenos Aires, where yesterday we had there was a meeting, a session of the GAC Working Group on Human Rights and International Law. We have a public meeting and a working session of the cross-community party, working party on ICANN's corporate and social responsibility to respect human rights. And we have, luckily, meetings like this with different constituencies to elaborate a bit on our work. And we also had a new report out, which was published by Article 19, and which might be adopted soon by the cross-community working party. You might ask, why are we doing this? So in Article 4 of ICANN's Articles of Incorporation, it reads that ICANN is bound to operate for the benefits of the internet community as a whole, carrying out its activities in conformity with relevant principles of international law and applicable international conventions. And so while ICANN's policies and operations have the potential to impact human rights, we would need to see how would this does this and create a framework to that to ensure that ICANN lives up to its obligations. To do this, we work off international standards for this kind of work. And first of all, we start from the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, and for the corporate and social responsibility work, we work off the UN Global Compact, probably known to several of you in the commercial sector. And then there are also the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights for the ICT sector, which are even more specified for the ICT sector. I would like to really make clear that with the Cross-Community Working Party, we're not aiming to expand ICANN's mission in any way, form, or sense. We're just trying to ensure that ICANN's policies and operations are aligned with human rights. So we managed to establish a charter for the Cross-Community Working Party as a reference. I will shortly map the highlights from that charter. First of all, it's raising awareness in the community on what this could be. Map policies, procedures, and operations that impact human rights. Provide information, suggestions, and recommendations to chartering organizations and the ICANN community. Propose procedures and mechanisms for human rights impact assessment. Develop and explore CSR guidelines that are in place or should be created. And produce position papers and statements where appropriate. On a final note, I would like to very much invite you to the to join or follow this work, either on the public session on Wednesday from 9:30 to 11, or during the open working session from 5 to 6 on Wednesday, or join the mailing list. And you can find the mailing list and the reports and more information at the website that you can find via the short URL, tinyurl.com/cchumanrights.
Okay, thank you very much. I will open up for questions in a second. But just for clarification, what is the current status of the group and the status of the charter? I was a little bit confused by that. Can you clarify that?
Thank you very much for that question, Tony. Since we're working off a cross-community working party and not a cross-community working group, the cross-community working party is a relatively new and informal instrument to go ahead. So the charter is more of a terms of reference that we agreed on with everyone who was on the mailing list to agree on the work that we would be doing and to guide that.
Okay, thanks. That's where my confusion came, because I wasn't quite sure in my own mind where the working party came from and how it operated. Okay, thanks. Anybody want to pick up on this at all? Greg?
I guess just a follow-up from my education, which is where in the ICANN policies it sets out how cross-community working parties are put together, and also how a drafting team was put together for this charter, and who the chartering organizations at ICANN would be that would actually charter this. And thanks.
Thank you very much for that question, Greg. We had this discussion in the last public session in Singapore, and we asked ourselves, should we go ahead and form a cross-community working group and then have official chartering organizations and go ahead like that? But then it was said that with the current work on the IANA and on accountability, it might be too much of a work to set up a formal cross-community working group. So we went ahead with a cross-community working party, and we had members from different parts of the community work on that. So we tried to see how much interest is there in this, how much work can be done before we see, and if it's necessary to come up with a cross-community working group.
If you could answer the question about where in ICANN's policies and procedures or the GNSO's policies and procedures, where it sets out how a working party is formed.
It is not defined. It is therefore an informal working form.
Okay. Thank you. David.
Thank you. David Ferris. A few questions. First, could you share the terms of reference with us? Because I don't think that I've seen the terms of reference for the working party. And could you also, when you share that, identify how we might be able to have colleagues join you? Because I think that several of us from the business community do look forward to participating in the work. And now, my question, on a substantive perspective. Do the terms of reference address the human rights that you're looking at, and are they focused on globally recognized human rights and the entire set of globally recognized human rights that might impact the DNS?
Thank you very much for that question. So, first of all, I shared the last report with Tony that could perhaps share it over your list. And as an annex, there is the terms of reference. So there you can find that. And I would invite you all also to join the mailing list and a discussion, which is completely open and completely public, as are the archives. So you can join and work on the join our work there, as well as during the two public and the public session and the open working session. Where we are in terms of which human rights that we'll work on and that will be adaptable, that is still we're still scoping. We did not want to start off with assumption and presumption, so that's why we look at established standards for doing human rights impact assessments. And in the last report, we saw what are the different standards that are used in the industry and in practice and in the guiding principle to make a proper analysis. We didn't want to come off with this off the bat and just try to reinvent the wheel, because as you probably know, many big companies do these kind of corporate social responsibility impact assessments, do these human rights impact assessments, and we want to learn and build on the existing practices. But of course, ICANN, as you all know, is a very unique environment. So we'll try to, how do we match those two? And that is currently on the top of the list of the discussions in the cross-community working party. And then subsequently, where do we fit that exactly within the work? So should there be an overall human rights framework? Should it be put as part of the PDP? Where should these different things be put? Who should execute them? How should we form the public comments on that? And how should we force the implementation? So we're at that phase, and we would very much like to benefit from your experience and knowledge on that as well.
Okay, thank you. Before we switch topics, last question, Steve, please. Okay. So I think because of the pressure of time, I'd like to thank you for coming along. Certainly, I think this is going to stimulate some discussion within the commercial stakeholder group, I'm sure. So thank you for that. And if I could ask Sharla or whoever's going to present on the GNSO reform to come along to the top table, that would be helpful. Thank you. Okay, so just whilst you guys are getting organised, I would suggest we have only got a small slot here of around about 15 minutes, and the important thing I believe would be to focus down on the recommendations that come out, particularly some of the elements where we had some discussions earlier, certainly in the context of the GNSO meeting. But if we could focus on the recommendations and get straight to that, then I think it's the best use of our time. So. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Richard Westlake from Westlake Governance with Colin Jackson. We've had the privilege of meeting many of you. So could we possibly then move in the slide deck, please, firstly to the page which has the four themes of the recommendations. As background, our draft report is now open for public comment. That remains open until the 20th of July. So if you haven't had a chance to have a look, please take that opportunity. And it's that one there, right. What you'll see on the screen in front of you then is that we've come up with 36 recommendations. If you haven't read our review, you might want to read Section 1, which is the report summary, which gives you a quick overview without the depth of analysis, but it does include a full set of the recommendations at the end of that, and those recommendations are grouped under the four themes. And as you will see, the number of recommendations per theme varies quite significantly. So the first theme, we decided very simply to call it participation and representation, and there are 16 recommendations around that, of which in our estimate there are approximately five which we would see as the overarching ones, with the others following in underneath. That's not to say they're optional, but that the ones that you would perhaps focus on first would be those five. Then the second theme is continuous development, process improvement, including some amendments to the PDP process, or the PDP, sorry, it's tautology, with 14 recommendations in there. And for those who are involved in policy development, which I assume at some stage is almost all of you, there are some recommendations in there. Transparency, because it is very much part of the ICANN ethos and values, we do make four recommendations there. And because the GNSO doesn't work in a vacuum, but as a part of the ICANN whole, we've made two recommendations in this area which go to making sure that there is an alignment to the degree that is practicable and feasible, balancing the resources available, being people as much as anything else, people and their time, with the strategic direction of the whole of ICANN, to try to make sure that they are, that what the GNSO doing is at least consistent with delivering on the strategic plan that ICANN board has approved. You all have access, if you want it, to the various individual recommendations. I don't propose that either I or my colleague go through those one by one unless anybody would like us to. Very happy to take questions on it. Otherwise, I would also like to leave some time for Larissa to talk about what happens from here. The process is that the public comment period stays open until the 20th of July, so you have approximately another 4 weeks for those who wish to submit public comments, for those who haven't already done so at various stages of the process. And after that, we will then produce our final version of the report by the end of August, after which it is over to ICANN. It'll be submitted to start then going into the process for whether it is accepted, and if accepted, onto implementation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Questions on the story so far? Heather, please.
Thank you very much. Heather Forrest. I'm not sure if this is exactly the right time to ask the question. For those colleagues who weren't involved in the GNSO Council working sessions over the weekend, a question was raised in that session, and forgive me if I remember the number incorrectly, some 100-odd comments made as to structure, many of those expressing a degree of negativity around structure, unworkability, this sort of thing. And there's language specifically in your report recommending that the current structure of the GNSO be maintained. Could you speak to that, please, for those who weren't in the weekend session?
Thank you, Heather. Yes, you're exactly right, and we did have that discussion before. We've also had quite significant discussions on it at previous sessions, and I'm very happy to comment on it, but I would certainly suggest that we don't get bogged down in that, because that was not within our terms of reference. I would have thought there may be more productive time spent in this and other meetings in the matters that were and in the deliverables that came from there. But certainly in answer to your question, if I could, Heather, first, I will answer your question if I may. Yes, there were approximately 120 comments, unsolicited. They recommended raise issues of problems that some people detected, some dissatisfaction that people had. But from our recollection, I can't remember anybody coming up with any alternative solutions as to what would be a better system. So what we said was two things. First of all, that we are very conscious that structural change can be enormously time-consuming and distracting, and in our view would not address the substantive issues which are covered by our 36 recommendations.
Apologies. May I, Heather Forrest, may I just clarify my question? In light of, as you rightfully pointed out, the limited scope of this review, can you comment as to why you've made positive, affirmative statements in the report recommending that the current structure be maintained?
Certainly. Richard Westlake again. The reason we said that we believed that it was appropriate to maintain it, at least for the time being, was we're aware of how difficult and hard-fought it was and hard-argued over several years to get to the structure you now have. And therefore, if anybody is thinking of perhaps taking one card out of that pile of a very complex structure, we would caution against doing so until you have agreed among yourselves, or had agreed upon you, if you must, something that will replace it that will be certainly no worse. But until that happens, it is functioning. It may not be efficient, it may not be simple, it may not please everybody, but it probably displeases most people about evenly. Everybody is to a degree discontented with it. Well, I wouldn't, that's a generalization, it's not absolutely true. But in our view, there has not been any consensus as to what would be a better structure, and therefore, in order to address the substance, keep at least one of the known factors constant until those are in, and then the point that we also made, Heather, was that post that, it's over to the GNSO itself. If it chooses then to say, well, the structure we have is not fit for purpose or there is something better, there is absolutely nothing preventing the GNSO taking that initiative, and indeed the board has said exactly as much. If you've got better ideas for structure, go for them.
Yes, if I may just add something to that. It is true that there was quite a number of unsolicited comments that were adverse comments on the structure. On the whole, people weren't asked to comment on the structure, so those who might have wished to comment positively on it didn't do so. In our interviews, we did receive quite a lot of positive feedback on the structure as well. So I'm merely adducing that to show that there is a balance to be had here. The structure is not uniformly loathed. The other point that you will notice in our recommendations is that whilst we say that we believe you should continue with the current structure and try to make it work, that we do recommend liberalising the process for creation of new constituencies, which would have a structural impact if that is to go ahead.
Thank you. I saw two hands, but before I go there, could I just ask one clarifying question? You made a statement that you felt the degree of dissatisfaction was pretty widespread, yet you received 101 comments. Did you do any analysis of where those comments come from to substantiate that is the case? Because my own belief is that you will find a huge degree of dissatisfaction within this stakeholder group and within the non-contracted parties' house. I do not believe that you would find the same degree of dissatisfaction with the other house. So did you do that analysis?
Formally, we didn't know, to be honest.
I don't have statistics on that, Tony, but what I can tell you is that I received adverse feedback on the structure from both houses and positive feedback from both houses, so it's not quite as simple as that. And there is the usual thing that nobody will be surprised about this. Virtually every part of this organisation thinks that every other part has too much power.
Okay, thank you. Marilyn.
Let me defer my question. I'll take it up. I want to talk about the future, and I can take that up. Separately.
Okay, thanks. Ron.
Thank you very much. And thanks, Richard, and you guys. And I was part of that working group, and I know the amount of efforts going into it, so I really appreciate it. Clearly, we have this difficult situation. It just seems to me that if so many people are saying the structure is broken, it's a very difficult one for us to understand why we should be keeping the structure. It just doesn't make sense. If the majority are saying we should change, why wouldn't your report say maybe you should put together a working group, discussion group, work party? We've got all these beautiful names now that are non-PDP names just to dodge that bullet. because we know if it goes that way, nothing's going to happen. Why wouldn't you recommend that we put together some kind of a working group and think this one through? Because it just, you said there's no alternative solution. No one's come up with an alternative solution because no one's putting the time into it because we're busy doing so many other things. But if a recommendation came back from the body reviewing the GNSO and said, you might want to sit down and have a group of people work on this, that would then lead to that work. So I'm just wondering why the recommendation would be keep it as it is. I know it's broken, but it's the only thing you have. That doesn't really work for us. We're trying to grow into a bigger and better organization. So I'm just, could you flesh it out a little bit for me? Thank you.
Before we go there, we will answer that. I'll hand back to the team, but Steve.
My question was actually on another topic, so if you want to go ahead and have them answer.
Richard.
Yes. Thank you, Ron. Just to comment on what you said, I would reiterate that the structure is not uniformly hated. There are some positives to it, in the opinion of many people whom we spoke to. And to say that if you do liberalize the constituency process, you will wind up with a structure which feels different. But also, a factor in our mind was it has cost you a lot of blood, sweat and tears to get the structure implemented. It's only actually been in this situation for a relatively brief period in the life of the GNSO. We really think that with the liberalisation of constituencies, we are proposing that you should try to give this a go for a few more years before you throw it out, perhaps at the next review, if that's still causing such great problems.
And if I could add, Ron, we would absolutely recommend that once our report is finalised, if it is accepted, that you work through those recommendations first, because once you have gone through the substantive issues there, then you've actually got a basis on which to determine what structure should be there, because remember, the form should follow the function, not the other way around. And again, we do caution that structural matters, not just in ICANN but in every organisation, can be enormous distractions, as indeed they were from about 2007 to 2011. And some people did comment that the focus on structure, trying to get an adequate structure, virtually brought to a halt an awful lot of otherwise valuable substantive policy development work, which after all is what the GNSO is here for.
Steve.
Steve Metallitz. I'm not going to belabor that point. I think you've heard my view on it, and many people around this table think your report is really focused on rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. But let me ask about one of those chairs. In the working group portion, recommendation 16, you talk about a policy impact assessment be included as a standard part of any policy process. And it wasn't clear to me whether you thought who would do that? Is that something the working group is supposed to do as it develops the policy? Is it something that's done retrospectively? It just wasn't clear to me, and it's obviously an additional step in what is already a very complicated and protracted process. So I wonder if you could just briefly say what do you mean by a policy impact assessment? Who would do it, and where would it come in the process?
Colin here. Thank you, Steve, for the question. And that's a very fair question, even if you do regard it as a deck chair. Now, the policy impact assessment, there are standards for these things. I mean, they are commonly done in, say, governments when they're proposing policy changes. Whilst I haven't Googled for one, I feel sure that I could pop up a template fairly easily, and perhaps that's something we could consider doing. It would seem to me that that would be something that a working group could ask staff to do, to create an impact assessment. In other words, what will break if we do this? Who will be adversely affected? What are the communications challenges in implementing this? What are the potential negatives of moving ahead here? What are the potential positives as well? Unintended. It's really a matter of trying to flush out unintended consequences before moving ahead, and before somebody else spots them further down the track and derails the whole process.
And you concluded that the current policy development process doesn't include those aspects. I'm speaking as the co-chair of a working group that's spent 18 months, and now we've produced our initial report. We've spent a lot of time trying to assess the impact. I mean, that's what that's what our job is. So I'm not sure, what are you trying to add to this process here that's not already there?
I guess it needs to be clear to those who are reading your outputs that that has been done, and that needs to be done in some form of structured process so that it must be seen to have been assessed in the same way for all the proposed policy. That is our recommendation.
Okay, thanks. We have to cut off there. Thank you very much for coming. I have absolutely no doubt you will be getting some response back from these three constituencies to the report, and this has really helped focus our minds towards that. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for your feedback, and we look forward to your comments through the public process.
Thank you. Could I ask Chris to come to the front, please? Thank you very much. Appreciate your joining us. So I'm going to hand over to Chris, who's going to bring us up to date with the changes on the digital services front. So, Chris, thank you.
This is Chris Gift. Thank you very much for your time. I will be brief. I did want to specifically update you on a couple of things, but the most important one was membership management. Sometime late last fall, I was approached by a number of stakeholder groups who had expressed a problem. They were administratively managing their stakeholder group. You know, membership was increasingly a burden for them. You know, collecting dues, managing events, and so on. A dull subject, but nonetheless one that's very important. So over the past few months, I've been working with a number of groups, gathering requirements, and investigating potential solutions, and I just wanted to come back very rapidly to this group to let you know where we stood. We have found a provider. The provider will offer everyone a website plus a membership management application. It has a number of functionality that I'll share with you in just a moment. We've secured budget under my group, so we'll be able to pay for the service for this year and you know, in the coming years. The next step is basically we'd like to run a beta. I know the NCSG is interested in running the beta. I know the IPC, we've been talking with Greg, the IPC would like to do a beta as well, participate in that. So if there are any others, I think ISPCP this evening, I think we're going to have a discussion about participating in the beta. If there are any others, please let me know. Though if we get more people, it'll just be production at that point because everybody will be using it. But nonetheless, our hope is to then roll it out to everybody in the early fall sometime. Next slide. Just for those who are interested, these are the types of things that these services will be able to support. So if you don't already do these things or they're cumbersome, I think this will be able to help you in those areas and hopefully greatly reduce the administrative burden for you and your volunteers. I do think one other thing in this area, I think it started to, as I talked to other people, is it's obviously started to engender other ideas about what else we could offer as a package service to the stakeholder groups and constituencies. So, you know, could we offer help in writing content or editing content or other areas? So that's, I think, something we could continue to discuss. Are there any questions about the membership management or...
Did I see somebody want to raise that? One of the things I'll raise, you mentioned on here dues collection and payment processing. That's certainly something I think we've had some discussions about in the past that has caused particular problems. Have you looked at some of the issues around that? Because it was always my understanding that's something that ICANN certainly wouldn't want to take on.
Let me be clear, we wouldn't be hosting any of this. So people were very clear that they didn't want ICANN hosting their membership management or their necessarily even their website.
Sorry, Chris, specifically the collection of dues and the payment process.
And banking, Tony.
So you can, they provide the payment processing. You would have to have your own banking and work with the payment processing gateway, right? But they have the service. So no, ICANN won't be providing any of the accounting or any of the banking back end, but this service does come with the dues collection software, the ability to manage that, to manage the dues, and integrated with the payment processing gateway.
I see two people with their hands raised, Mark and Marilyn.
Yeah, just for clarity on this, I think some of the discussions that at least I've had involve a third-party off-the-rack system. At least that's something that's being considered for provision. And so it wouldn't be ICANN really hosting or providing any of this, but just providing a third-party solution with the ability to have that solution customized to the needs of the individual stakeholder group.
That's correct.
So ICANN would merely be paying for it and providing a limited number of dollars towards customization and so forth. And many of these solutions include payment processing through their own service provider. So you wouldn't have to set up necessarily any complicated banking or other dues collection mechanisms that don't really already exist.
Okay, thanks. Marilyn.
Thank you. I'll defer to Jimson as the Vice Chair for Finance and Operation on further questions, but my question is more detailed, Chris, and that is, if such a service were provided and funding for that as a routine offering were to be provided by ICANN, would ICANN also be able to provide training and support to the secretariat, part-time secretariats that also support the constituencies so that they would be able to utilize this?
Yes, I confirm that this comes with a whole training package, and we'll be training the staff as well as training will be available to people who would self-administer their groups. The last very quick topic is, I won't, not a lot of detail here, but just that we are on the ICANN.org, we're very aware that many of the groups are not present or not fully present on ICANN.org. We're working to correct that. We're redesigning several sections of the website so that we can more effectively describe your groups and then push people to those groups, right? Push people to your websites. So we're working on this. As soon as we have something that we're not going to build it right away. We want to share it with you first and get your feedback and see what you think of the concepts. And then if you guys all appreciate it and think it works, then we will go ahead and implement it.
Christian.
Chris, I just wanted to say, we've been talking for a couple of years now about how to approach this particular subject. And we've talked a lot about the ways in which this would not work to try and approach it. And I wanted to commend you in providing a path forward that I think does address our concerns and needs about other paths that we had looked into. And thank you. I'm going to be eager to get into the guts of this and see whether the actual technological decisions that have been made are a good fit for our constituencies. But I think that what we see here addresses the things that we've been talking about as concerns for the past couple of years very effectively, and I thank you.
Thank you. Okay. It's good feedback. So thank you. Thank you for joining us, Chris. Again, there'll be some further discussion within house on this, I'm sure. So we need to end our meeting here. We need to move to the room to meet the board. Can someone remind me where that is? Anyone know? Okay, thank you. And we need to wrap up here. So thank you for your participation. We've covered a lot of ground. Thanks very much.